I'm going to tell you, with this fantastic weather today and my cold, all of them coming together in conjunction, I am almost an uncontrollable animal mote in the great unseeing eye of existence. I'll tell you, the blood is flowing, the juices are squirting through my veins like an enormous sluice. Or is it sluice? How do they pronounce that, Bob, anyway? Where the guys pan the gold? Sluice? 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 I don't know. You guys who watch Westerns out there, you ought to know. Gabby, isn't it Gabby Hayes who's always down there with that pan? But I don't know. It's a dangerous time. Of course, who was it? T.S. Eliot, somebody along the line, pointed out that April is the cruelest month. Well, oh yes, there's some truth to that, and it's just about to happen. And I suspect the reason that April is the cruelest month is that you have a vague, better than a vague sensation that since. You see, you can kind of hide in the wintertime. You can always pretend it's the weather. Yeah, you can always, you know, the weather is making you feel rotten. Or it's, you hibernate in a sense. You do, you mentally hibernate, and suddenly it's gone, and the cover is gone, the shield is gone. You're dragged out of your foxhole. And you know, whether or not you can say it, you know that something is there. It's like there's a kind of retribution. I don't know what it is. Something sinister there out in the darkness. And even though the wind is blowing through your hair and the yeast is flowing through your veins and the sap is rising, it's up near your knees now, there nevertheless is the sense of an imminent danger. I can't explain what it is. Maybe it's yourself. I don't know. But these things take many forms. I will remember I don't know whether to tell this story. You know, I've hesitated telling this story ever since I came on the air here in New York, primarily because the stars of the story live in New York. No, I don't know whether I should tell you that story or not. I'll have to give fake names and everything to it. I can't tell you the story. And you better get Carl, because Carl would enjoy this one. You'll enjoy this one, Bob. And I don't know whether I should tell it or not. I say this. The only reason that we should be allowed to tell this story is because it's Monday night and there's nobody listening anyway. They're not here, and who cares anyway? I mean, I'm sure that at this hour all the officials are in bed or wherever they are, you know. That covers a lot of territory there. And it's Monday. And I think we can get away with a lot of jazz. Not really get away with it. It isn't so much that. Don't misunderstand me. It's that there are sometimes you can say things and sometimes you can't. That's all. It's not a matter of chickening out. It's not a matter of selling out. It's just that the timing is right on certain things. And I don't know whether to tell you this story. All right, Al, stand aside now and I'll tell you the story. Now, first of all, I want all of you out there who will raise your hands, I want to swear all of you to absolute secrecy on this. Seriously, I don't want anybody chickening out and talking about this to the other side. Now, seriously, I just must hear from one person who will say it for all of you. I want to hear somebody. I want to hear it. I want to hear it in somebody's own words. I want to hear it. Shepherd, I will not breathe a word of what you say tonight to anybody, because it is a fantastically embarrassing moment I'm about to relate. And it tells a great deal about, well, what the unwashed call human nature. By the way, that's a great catch-all phrase. How many times have you run into this low-browed slob, you know, with the beetling brows? He's just maybe a millimeter removed from Neanderthal man. And he'll say to you, well, one thing about me is, well, I got a good knowledge of human nature. What the devil is human nature? I'm not quite sure. Maybe Freud touched on it. I don't know. But I want one guy to raise his crummy, wet palm, his miserable, detruncated paw, and say, I will not say anything about what you are telling tonight, because, believe me, if the weather wasn't so great, if my head wasn't so full of blood, and if my nose wasn't stopped up so much, I wouldn't tell you. It's obvious. I recognize already how dangerous it is. It's not dangerous. It's just the kind of thing you don't talk about, you know? You're with such a rotten mo. Is there a guy? I want to hear it. No, he's going to say it probably. Hello? Yeah, well, talk it out loud. Don't mutter. Yes. You swear what? Will you please say that louder? I can't hear you. I swear to what? Yeah, well, say it loud, even with the laryngitis. You swear to what? Oh, for crying. All right, baby, thank you very much. You notice how many chicks chicken out right at the crucial moment? There it is. Gets me on the phone. She squeaks. Well, okay. No. Don't quit. I don't want to hear anymore. No. Quit calling up. I don't want you. I'll tell it anyway. I know that you're not going to chicken out anyway, because you won't remember by tomorrow morning what you heard tonight anyway, being a good American. The average American can't remember, believe me, on Friday, he can't remember Wednesday's big news story. He can't at all. That makes us so lovable in the world, you know. It's so lovable. We don't remember history. I'm interested. To the average hippie I meet, history began in 1945, or roughly when they dropped the atom bomb. Anything else was just kid stuff, you know, playing around. I don't know anything about history. So that's a very endearing quality, and I think Americans have it in abundance. So you won't remember by tomorrow morning what you heard tonight, which you're going to make it all right. Well, I'll tell you. Picture the scene. It is springtime. It is springtime, and I am working for the government. And I'm working in the department of the government where they issue you a brown suit. And as a matter of fact, like many government workers, I spend a good deal of my time walking around with a long stick with a pin on the end of it, sniping butts. Various things of that kind. And yes, I'll never forget one spring morning that me and another 500 guys traversed over 500 yards on our knees in a gravel parking lot. On our knees in a gravel parking lot, picking the grass out from between the gravels, which is exactly the way that rotten, crummy sergeant put it. I want all you guys to pick all them grasses out from between the gravels. Get down on your knees and get going. Move. You will be given 5 minutes out of every hour for a five-minute break when you can stand up and get rid of the crick in your back. But between them cricks, I want you to get down and pick out them grasses from between the gravels.
Well, that was one of my introductions to spring and the beautiful sight of grass growing, the eternal burgeoning of nature. And so we crawled on our knee pads across the officer's parking lot, plucking grass out individually. Well, it was a great thing for the mind. I learned a great deal, as a matter of fact. Oh, yes, I learned how to field strip everything. That, as a matter of fact, you're looking at a guy who personally is field stripped. Not only butts the whole bit, me, nothing left but fragments. But nevertheless, I'm going to tell you what happened one beautiful spring. Now, just, I'm going to trust all of you not to talk anything about this, because the guy who was the star of this unbelievable, fantastic moment lives right here in New York City, and I just hope to anything you can hope to that he's not listening. It illustrates the point, Bob, that, you know, we always believe, you know, it's a funny thing, especially Americans, we always believe that somehow justice catches up with the transgressors. You know, we always believe that. How many times have you heard an American say, well, don't worry, they'll get them in the end. You can't go forever. They'll get them in the end. This is a belief that Americans have. It runs through every one of our miserable Westerns on television. The bad guy gets it every time. We even have a rule, for crying out loud. The Hayes office, is it the Hayes office in the movie world, that has a rule that says, it is an absolute rule, bad guys gotta lose in every movie. In complete defiance of reality. And in complete defiance of the truth. But this is an accepted tenet of faith in America, that bad guys get it in the end. Well, for that reason, we are all walking around expecting to get hit in the back of the head any second. That is because, you know, we believe that bad guys are always going to get it. Well, we all secretly believe we're rotten. No question about it. It's part of the American faith, too. But nevertheless, that's why we have 4,500 committees that are called Fair Play to Transylvania. Fair Play to Peru. Hands off Venezuela. You know, that kind of stuff. And we don't have one committee that says, fair play to me. Not one, because we figure we're rotten. Fair play, we don't even deserve fair play. We don't even deserve to play. We're rotten, rotten, rotten people. Oh, yeah, you're rotten. The atom bomb, rotten people. Oh, remember Hiroshima. Oh, terrible. Well, it goes on and on. Well, one day I saw retribution in actual action. And let me tell you, it scared the living daylights out of me. Actually, it scared something else out of me, but the kids are around, you know? Speaking of kids, this is WOR AM and FM New York. It's spring, and I'm in the Army. Well, one of the beautiful things about the Army, and yet one of the sneaky things, it's a very strange combination of desires and cross purposes that come to rest in the Army. And this is one of the reasons why probably, I'd say a good half of America's fiction has been about the war, or a war, some kind or another. If you stand and look at a newsstand where they have all the magazines on sale, you will find at least half of the magazines, unless they're specialty magazines like women's fashion magazines or something, have an article about some war. This is the truth. It just continually goes. Well, wars have a funny thing. The Army particularly has a strange reaction on guys. Because it enables you at one time, Bob, to escape totally anonymously. We all have a secret desire to be completely anonymous. So nothing can be pinned on us, you know. Completely anonymous. If you could escape your name and everything. Not even look like you. You know how a kid has a secret desire when he's 14 or 12 to become invisible? Oh, this is a real lure to be invisible, you know, and go every place and do anything you want to do. You're invisible. Never see you. Well, that's what the Army does. The Army literally makes you invisible. Well, it makes you invisible in a subtle way. You put this thing on. They give you a number. They put you in the barracks with 45 other guys, all of whom look exactly like you. They cut your hair the same way. You eat the same food. And within 3 weeks, by George, you are invisible. You really are. You can do anything you want. You really can. And millions of guys did. Now, they didn't think it counted, you see. It didn't count like being back home, because back home you're not invisible. You know, you got this crummy suit. You picked up the gas pipe racks. Everybody recognizes that. Your name is Charlie Watson. Everybody knows old Charlie. You know, everybody. Yeah, you can escape. Well, in the Army, you can. So that gives a lot of leeway to guys. On the other hand, you're always trying to fight to be an individual, which is part of us, too. So you got these two things fighting. So, all right, you got the picture. It's springtime. It's beautiful, beautiful springtime. And I'm in the Army for a couple of years. And, of course, there were a lot of other guys in the Army. And I'm a kid. I'm a real kid type. Well, the Army had a program, which I will briefly describe. Did you ever hear of ASTP, Bob, the Army Specialized Training Program? Well, this was a program during the Army, during the war, where they sent guys to college. And you had to be qualified. You had to be in a certain age group. You had to be something like 17 to 21, something like that. You had to have a certain academic background. You had to have a certain kind of credits in high school and all this. And this was very, very, very difficult to get into, actually. You had to have certain IQ and all this jazz. You know, the whole Army routine. Well, they posted this all over the Army, every place, wherever guys were. If they were in North Africa, if they were in Greenland, any place they were, there was a notice on the bulletin board that says you can apply for this thing. Well, of course, there were always notices on bulletin boards about how you could apply for paradise. There always were things, great things, and nobody ever expected to get them. You know this is true. There were always things like a special outfit is being formed to do nothing but dance on Saturday nights in the Pentagon and to yell whoopee every couple of hours and to drink beer. Special outfit being formed of special men. Well, you always read that kind of stuff, and you always heard about other guys getting sent to fantastic things. You never believed you would ever do it. At least I never did. But everything that came up that looked like it would make it possible for me to escape that rotten, crummy outfit I was in, I signed up for. Oh, yo, yo, what an outfit, I should tell you. Oh, boy, I start sweating. I'm telling you, my feet sweat. My mind goes blank when I think of that rotten outfit that I was in at that time. I was in an outfit. I was in a heavy signal construction battalion. What sounds more deadly than that? And I'll tell you, it was deadly. First of all, heavy signal construction battalions had about a 99.9% casualty rate. Just automatically. The first thing they did was shoot every guy that appeared on a battlefield carrying a telephone pole. He was dead. Forget it. You know, just automatically. Any guy that had a roll of wire, blow him up. You know, he's obviously going to connect it up with a general's headquarters, something that blow him up. Well, so it was really a crummy outfit. Well, all the guys are signing up to getting out. Well, months go by. I'm digging holes. I'm throwing wire. I'm yelling. I'm climbing up telephone poles. I'm sweating. I'm getting fist fights. The whole business is going on in this rotten outfit. And one day they call me down into the orderly room or the tent. And the captain says, "What is this?" And I says, what? Yes, sir, what? You know, always, you always expect to get caught on something. You're always cheating something. I figure, what is it? He found out about the steak I got the other day when I was on TPO. What is this? Look at this. And he's got a paper. He's waving it at me. What is this? And I'm covered with tar and old rubber from the oil and from the throwing the wire out. And my pants are torn and I'm sweating and I'm mad. And, I'm just teed off. What is this? What is this thing? Come here. What is ASTP? What is this stuff? And I says, "What is it, Captain?" I don't know. Well, it seemed like about a year before I had applied for this thing, and it came through. Shepherdess now transferred to ASTP. You never heard of it. What is this college stuff? College? What do you need college? You don't need college to drive that truck you're driving? You need college to dig them holes? You need college to throw that wire out? Yeah. Bye, chicken. And I said, "College? Oh, boy." And all of a sudden, I can't believe it. I'm going to go. So I run back to the tent. I'm falling down. I'm hitting my head on the tent pegs. You know, I can't believe I'm going to get sent. And it's just unbelievable. And sure enough, they sent me. Well, it's funny. Well, I arrived at this college, which we'll just say is nameless, except that for the purposes of the argument, we'll call the University of Maryland. There is no such college. That is just a name that we have invented. And so I will call it that. It is the University of Maryland. And so I arrive at this college, a lone, trudging figure, after having gone through several various processing stations, and now they're sending me to this place. And I was just out of my skull, you know, unbelievable. I'm wearing a clean shirt. And for the first time in, like, it seemed like 150 years, I am not lugging a piece with me. I have thrown away my Springfield. I do not carry now. I'm not wearing my gas mask. You can't believe how great it feels not to have a canteen hanging on you. You know, just automatic. You put all this junk on. So I'm dressed like people. You see, even in spite of the fact I got a suit. Well, one of the rules of this unit was when you get to this place, nobody has any rank. You are now called a cadet, which means that you could have been almost anything. You see. The rumors were that some guys had been warrant officers. Other guys were privates. It was a total leveling process. You were just called cadet. You were paid the same thing. They took all stripes. If you had any stripes on you, you took them off. You put on a special insignia so that everybody was equal now in this outfit. Of course, they knew what you had been down in the orderly room. It didn't make any difference. Nobody else did. So you were just nothing. You were just cadet so-and-so. Cadet Shepherd. That's all. Oh, it was a great moment, see. For once, you know, I escaped. I had been T5 Shepherd, which is even lower than a private in a strange way. I'll tell you, a T5 is a guy that they grudgingly know, Bob, they should give some rank to. You know, Bob? A T5 is a guy they grudgingly know they should give some, but they can't trust them. So they give him this T5 rank, which is, you know, it's like giving you a rank and then taking it back real quick. It's like saying, "Look, you're the chief, but the word chief doesn't count in your case. You're just nothing, actually. But you get the pay." So I get down to this place, and there were about like 800 other guys. Now, got the scene. All of us have been shorn of all identification. And they don't even, they even take away your insignia that tells what branch of the Army you're in. You know, there were Signal Corps guys. Well, they took away my Signal Corps pin, you know. There were Air Corps guys. They took away their wings. There were guys that were in the artillery. They took away the artillery. Everything. They gave you just little USs, you know, and the whole bit. Absolutely stripped you down. It was great. You know, all of a sudden, all that rotten stuff, oh, boy, it's all gone. So I was feeling like a new man. Well, I'm walking around. And they assigned us to the college dormitories. Well, I'm there in about 5 minutes. They assign guys. There's a guy who's in the same room with me. You know, roommates they assign. There's about 15 guys all in this little bunch of rooms, and there's about 20 guys down the hall. And we're all sitting around, and we're all there. You see, we're all eyeing each other suspiciously, but nobody has any rank. Remember, nothing on them. See. Well, of course, we all knew that these guys could have been anything. A guy could have been a warrant officer. Could have been anything, you know, all the way up and down. It was only for warrant officer and below, right down to private. But believe me, the difference between a warrant officer, Bob, and a private is like, well, please, I mean, you know. So it could be almost anything. And everybody's sort of eyeing everybody else. And the first day, we all go down to the place where they're going to feed us, which is in the college mess hall, the college, what do they call it, the college dining room. And there's chicks in there and everybody, you know, all the college students are there. And we sort of sidle in, we sit down, all in our dress uniforms. And the whole little thing, the whole little schlemoo began to build. Everybody's, say, fella, that's not the way we did it in the Air Corps. Of course, you know, it's fun. You don't know where this guy came from. He says, out of the Air Corps. And somebody says, where were you, Mac? He said, Truax failed. Well, of course, 90 million guys were Truax fan. Yeah, well, yeah, well, waste gunner. And so on down the line. The whole business is going, and everybody's talking back and forth. And I'm just sitting there. I'm playing the scene. I'm listening to the words going on. And there was one guy in our outfit. And I'm going to have to invent his name. This guy is from New York. Now, I hadn't met many guys from New York before this, you see. Contrary to the movies, they did not distribute the army in the neat little capsule units that Van Johnson always led. You know, one guy from Brooklyn and another guy named Tex. There's always a guy named Tex. And then Sidney Poitier is always in the outfit. I just never saw it like that. They were just a whole bunch of rabble. I mean, they were from nowhere. You know, I hardly ever met a guy you could discern where he was from. They were all just in the army. I mean, they were nothing. It was just everybody in the army. So nobody, it just wasn't as neat as Norman Mailer has, you believe, either. You know, there were just a lot of guys. So this guy was from New York, distinctly from New York, and the first time I had ever really met a genuine New York big-time operator. And he was about 6'3". Let's call him, for the purposes of the story, let's call him Bill Smithers. And Bill Smithers was a big guy, about 6'3", weighed about 205 pounds. He was clear-eyed and square-jawed. And he was two rooms down from me. So one day, the second day, we arrived. None of us knew each other very well. And there's a guy who's in the next bunk to me. He's in the room with me. A guy named Goldberg. And me and Goldberg are chewing the fat. Goldberg is the only guy I ever knew who smoked... What is this fantastic pipe tobacco that's purple when you smoke it? And has leaves on it. The smoke comes out with leaves and petals and little vines growing on it. He smoked, I don't know what that pipe tobacco was. I'll tell you, it's the first time my eyeballs were actually sweated. And it was, I'll tell you, it was like Saturday night in a you-know-what. It was just incredible. And there was always, in my room, I was a little college room, you know, there was always a heavy fog that hung from the ceiling down to about 3 feet from the floor, and you could escape if you came in on your hands and knees. So, naturally, I took the lower bunk, and it just hung there with vines hanging out of it. That was the kind of smoke. So me and Goldberg are sitting there one day. He was a great guy. Goldberg weighed about 300 pounds. So Goldberg and I are sitting at our desk, and Goldberg says to me, he says, hey, Shepard, he says, have you met this guy Smithers? And I said, no. He says, gee, he's a fantastic guy. And I said, why, what do you mean? He says, he's just a fantastic guy. He's a great guy. So I said, well, you know, great. What about him? He says, well, where do you meet him? He's just a great guy, the greatest guy I've ever met in the Army. So a couple of hours later, I'm down in the, we had a little lounge, see, and who's sitting across from me at the table but this guy Smithers? And Smithers is a great guy. He's got beautiful, sparkling eyes. You know, he's the kind of guy that everybody likes. You know, immediately you like this son of a gun. And he's sitting there, and he's entertaining everybody. He says, ah, so I says to the lieutenant, Lieutenant, you son of a gun. With that, I belts him in the mouth, and 5 minutes later, the MPs come. Well, of course, we're sitting there all boffing it up. He's entertaining the whole crowd. Every 5 minutes, he gets up, and he throws a nickel on the jukebox. So I says to the lieutenant, you son of a gun, if you don't give me another beer, I'll belt you. Well, we're sitting there listening to this thing. Well, the word got out that Smithers had had one of the most remarkable Army careers that I'd ever heard of. And I had heard of a lot of remarkable Army careers, mine for one. I didn't talk much about it, but it was awful remarkable if they ever knew. So it turns out Smithers one day, and this is about the third day, he's sitting there and he starts to tell his story again. And he says, well, I'll tell you. He says, I don't like to talk much about it, but since all of us have been G2'd, we had. G2 would mean we had gone through, you know, the whole investigation by the FBI. Since all of us have been G2, and I guess it's all right for me to talk. But any of you guys ever heard of the OSS? Wow. I mean, you know, the OSS, that was, during the war in the Army, that was just a rumor, you know. There was the OSS is this crack elite outfit where guys parachute into Norway. You know, they blow up bridges. And they parachute by night into Berlin and steal Hitler's secrets. And, you know, sneak back disguised as French peasants, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, any of you guys ever hear of the OSS? Yeah. Well, I guess it's all right. Might as well tell you. You know, they don't actually assign a man to the OSS like a regular outfit. A man is assigned, really, on special orders right out of Washington. It's not like regular assignment, you know. And, well, I guess it's all right to tell you about it. Of course, by this time, all of us are sitting on the edges of our seats. And we want to know, oh, come on, Smithers, tell us. He says, well, any of you ever hear of General Simon Bolivar Buckner? General Buckner? Yeah, you know, oh, wow, General Buckner. Well, I'll tell you who General Buckner was. General Buckner was the general who was in charge of the entire Alaska Department, and he was in charge of the invasion of Attu and Kiska and all the Aleutian Islands. He says, well, you ever hear of General Simon Bolivar Buckner? Yeah. He says, well, actually, what I did before I was assigned to the ASTP unit, I was General Bolivar's, well, shall we put it this way, advisor. Advisor? You know, advisor. Yeah, he says, well, actually, he says, you know, the OSS takes special men who have special skills, language skills and special technical skills, and assigns them to various officers as special intelligence advisors. And he says, why, General Bolivar Buckner would never go anywhere without me for long periods of time. There was Kiska, there was Attu. There's a lot of things I could tell you, but of course, a lot of things just can't be told, but one day they will be told. A lot of things I can't tell you about what's going to happen up there in that Aleutian command, but, well, we'll just have to let history resolve itself. Of course, we're all sitting there with our tongues hanging out. And so one of the guys says, well, what kind of a rate did you have, Bill? He says, you're probably wondering why I'm here. Well, I'll tell you. There is a point in the OSS when a guy gets so that he knows too much. And they just decided that since that point had been reached with me and that I'd outlived my usefulness, too many people knew me, assigned me to whatever I wanted to pick. And so I picked ASTP. I wanted to take engineering. But, of course, my lips are sealed. Boy, I'm telling you, all of us, he wouldn't even tell us what rank the son of a gun was. He was the general's advisor, you know? So we're sitting there with our eyeballs hanging up. Well, about 2 days go by, and Bill's reputation was 17 feet high. I mean, he was, without a question, he was one of the most convincing guys. He was one of the greatest guys I've ever met. And there was the quality about him of the same kind of quiet strength that Gary Cooper had. The same sort of lethal energy that John Wayne radiates. And he'd sit there casually, his tight pants pulled up, you know, and he had these shirts all cut down. He really looked like he was stripped for action all the time. And, oh, of course, the word was out that any time you go to town and you get in trouble, you're really damn lucky if you got Bill with you, because you know how they train those OSS guys. You just back of the neck and he's dead. These guys do it not even a sound, you know. These are real killers. Well, Bill, of course, didn't say much about that. You better leave. I mean, you better get down there to QXR where they're playing that hiding thing, that nice quiet thing, because this is awful. It's just embarrassing. It's just incredible for me to even think back on it now, Bob. Go ahead now. Leave, all of you that can't take it. Now, I'll tell you what happened. There was a notice appeared on the bulletin board. See, before I do this, I want to tell you that
It was this that really convinced me that there is somewhere hiding up in the woods, there is an avenging force. I don't know what it is. It might be the giant bowling ball of life. And it's liable to come rolling down that alley any minute now, and pow! Guess who's that big number one pin standing up there? That's right. Phoning it up. Okay. Be careful. Well, there was a notice on the bulletin board. It says, all EM of the battalion will assemble in the gym at 1200 noon. And we were about to be processed. Up to this time, we had only been taking little tests. We had not started school. And it's a beautiful spring day. Oh, I will never forget it. The sun is shining and the birds are birding and the trees are treeing and it's popping out there. And you could just feel it, you know. The chicks are, oh, yo, yo, yo. They are blossoming and everybody felt wonderful. We're whistling and hollering. And Bill is leading the pack and Gasser is singing and Goldberg is smoking his pipe. And we're all going down there. Because each one of us escaped a fate worse than death by being sent to this place. And we know it. We know that we're lucky. So we're just living it. We're just living every rotten, lovely, great, fantastic moment of it. And the rolling hills and the beautiful university. Boy, what a far cry from all those joints, you know, and from the heavy signal construction battalion. And already the awful images are retreating into the distance, and I'm walking along in the sun. And we all go into the gym, the college gym, great big gym. And there's a little platform. And on the platform was a couple of lieutenants, and there's the battalion sergeant major. He's a big master sergeant. And, of course, these are very official type guys. They're the clerical type sergeants. And these are the clerical type lieutenants. And the first thing that happens as we file in, Bob, the sergeant is saying into the PA system, all right, you men, I want all of you, as soon as you get in, I want all of you to squat down, sit down on the floor anywhere. I want you to be quiet. Because we want to get this little business over quick. It's just going to take a few minutes, and it'll be a great help if all of you will cooperate with us. As soon as you get inside, sit down now. All right, all you guys over by the door, sit down on the floor. Sit down now. Get out. All right. All right, all of you, now quiet. Are they all in, Corporal? Okay, you guys, now. We are going to fill out a special form that we use here in ASTP that is for our files. We call it a transfer of record form. Number ASTP7026SJ7D. This form is merely a form which we use for our own files and is purely confidential. It works like this. Ordinarily, in a battalion, when a group of men arrive, these forms are transferred by the battalion clerks. We do not have the sufficient clerical personnel in this outfit to accomplish that duty. So we are going to ask your cooperation, and we want you to help us and do it very carefully, as follows. With that, he turns to a blackboard with a piece of chalk. You will be issued your Form 32. As we call out your name, as you'll see over to my left here, a stack of records. These are the complete records of each one of you men's, right here. And as I call out your name, I want you to come quickly to the front, and the corporal will hand it to you and take it back to your place. And with it, you will take back one of the forms. And then when all of these have been passed out, this is the way we will fill them out. You will notice up in the upper left-hand corner, it will say name, rank, serial number. You know how to fill that out, of course. You've filled out a lot of those. However, you will notice on the Form 32, it is a keyed form, which on the left shows the various organizations to which you've been assigned, the various theaters of war which you have been involved in, and the various decorations and the various actions that you have been part of. Now, that is a keyed form, and you will notice it reads from top to bottom. We wish you to transfer that to the white form as follows. Now, for example, if you were... Now, I will take a representative form now and show you how it is done. With that, out of 800 forms, he reaches down, he takes the top one, and he says, now, here we have a representative form of Private William Smithers. Private William Smithers, who is now, I see by the notation on the outside of the envelope, he is now in Barracks A in Company B.
Now, let's take a look at William Smithers and his record. He has always been a private. He has been in the Army 3.5 months. And let's see, William Smithers, now you'll notice at the top, he was originally assigned to Camp Clay, Louisiana, as a basic infantryman. And after 2.5 months completing basic there, he was assigned to clerical school, where he half completed the regulation forms and the regulation course for the 832 ASN, which, of course, is the company clerk. He did not complete that, however, since he was sent to ASTP. He has a relatively simple form. Now, we'll notice that he has never been out of the country, of course. He has never been assigned to an additional unit. We see here that his basic scholastic rating is rather interesting. He has completed 4.5 years of high school, the half year being an additional year where he was sent to a trade school. That is his complete schooling. And now, if there are any questions any of you would like to ask, and all of us are sitting back there in our little circle, and right in the middle of our little circle is Private Smithers, William B., PVT, Camp Clay, Louisiana, basic infantry rifleman, basic training, company clerk, half completed. And he's sitting there. And I'm sitting there. Goldberg is sitting there. Gasser's sitting there. And we slowly go up one after the other, and we get our forms. We come down. We fill it out, one after the other. And then we return to our seats. And that night, nobody says a word. We go through our classes. And that night, at 8 o'clock, when we all are quietly sitting around in our little lounge with the jukebox, nobody is saying anything. It was a thing you just couldn't say anything about. Smithers came in, said, anybody want to go down for a sandwich? Any guy want to go down for a sandwich? I said, how about it? Go down and get some of that meatloaf. How about it? And Gasser says, I got a lot of algebra I got to do, Bill. And Goldberg says, oh, I'm pretty tired, Bill. And Smithers says, how about you, Shep? I said, I'm going to help Gasser with his algebra. And Smithers went back out into the spring evening. And for 3.5 months, we all quietly lived together and never mentioned a single rotten word of it. Because of something very basic, each one of us was carrying his own turtle shell. And it was awful rickety.
This is WOR Radio.